Here next, International Construction Products LLC versus Caterpillar Inc. 25-1629 and 25-1635. Mr. Hicks, we'll start with you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. George Hicks for Caterpillar, and may it please the court. In its recent Ivy decision, the Supreme Court of Illinois held that for a plaintiff to obtain lost profits, quote, the nature of the business upon which anticipated profits are claimed must be such as to support an inference of definite profits grounded upon a reasonably sure basis of facts. In other words, as the court stated, lost profits must be proved with, quote, reasonable certainty. The profit assumptions for ICP, which were the sole basis for the remarkable $100 million verdict here, do not satisfy this legal threshold. As ICP's own witnesses testified, ICP was, quote, a new approach to selling construction equipment. No company had ever before sold new heavy machinery equipment online without a traditional dealer network, and tellingly, no company has done so since. Furthermore, ICP was selling machines made by an unknown Chinese manufacturer, Longqing, through a company, Iron Planet, that only had experience selling used, not new, machines. Yet even though ICP's business was conceitedly unprecedented in numerous respects, ICP's founder, Tim Frank, assumed that within 5 years, ICP would generate $1 billion a year in sales and capture 15% of the North American heavy equipment market. As those extraordinary numbers suggest, Frank's projections were based not on a, quote, reasonably sure basis of facts, as Illinois law requires, but instead on his own speculation. For example, in projecting sales, Frank did not review or rely on any company's sales data, not of other manufacturers already in the United States, not of Longqing, and not of Iron Planet. Instead, he came up with the sales numbers entirely in his head based only on his own prior experience at vastly different companies under vastly different business practices that ICP was admittedly departing from. Moreover, Frank's sales figures hypothesized that Longqing would come into compliance with US regulations, even though Longqing had not yet done so, and there was no evidence it would do so. His projections were so implausible that not one outside investor agreed to invest in ICP because, as Frank admitted, quote, the projections gave them pause.
Mr. Hicks, can we step back to the Ivy standard? Because that standard, which sounds like a very high one, is not one that you had asked the district court to present to the jury as part of jury instructions. What should we make of that, given the instructions that were actually given to the jury without objection?
Well, Your Honor, this is a legal question for the court. I think Ivy makes that clear. Ivy was a summary judgment decision, as was the TAS decision by the Seventh Circuit, which was also applying Illinois law, and it was actually quoted by Ivy. It's always been a legal threshold that the court decides and that has to determine whether there was, again, reasonable certainty or definite profits grounded upon a reasonably sure basis of fact. And that's why, after the verdict, Judge Andrews was able to look at the evidence and conclude that it did not satisfy that, as you said, high standard. And I think there's a reason for that. There's a number of examples in Mr. Frank's own testimony. These are his.
Before we get into that, we have a line of case law that says that acquiescence in jury instructions providing the wrong standard of law can constitute a forfeiture. Why didn't that take place here?
Well, Your Honor, I, with respect, I don't read ICP to be making that argument, but I think that it's because we had made the argument at Rule 50A that, and also at summary judgment, that that these profits were not reasonably certain, that they did not satisfy the Illinois threshold. And I don't believe that there was, you know, that that's sufficient to preserve for a legal question at the end. I mean, we certainly did argue that the profits did not satisfy Illinois law, that jury instructions were under Illinois law. I know that ICP is arguing now that it should be North Carolina law, but the instructions were given under Illinois law. The argument was made, we pressed that the profits were not definite, sufficiently definite, and we re-raised that in our Rule 50B motion after the verdict. I don't believe that ICP argued in opposition to that motion that there was any forfeiture or there was any jury instruction problem. So I think that there would be a forfeiture of forfeiture as well, but I don't think it's something that impedes affirming Judge Andrews' Rule 50B judgment, which I think was very well founded. I mean, there was simply no evidence in the record about the projections being based on any.
On the other side of the ledger, from the Ivy standard, we have the deference that we owe to a jury verdict. And that's also a very high threshold to get over. In addition to the experience on which Frank drew, he also had a committee of advisors, and the jury heard from two expert witnesses, one of whom did opine as to the reasonableness of the projections. Why isn't that enough for a sufficient foundation to uphold the jury verdict?
Well, Your Honor, Ivy itself says that, quote, experts may not guess the amount of potential lost profits where there is no historical data to demonstrate their likelihood. In Ivy, there were two experts who did exactly this, who opined that the projections had, quote, reasonable basis. And the court said that's inefficient because the problem is looking at those projections, those estimates in the first instance. Where do they come from? As James said, if they're not reasonably certain in the first place, having an expert come in after the fact and opine that he thinks that they would have been satisfied does not satisfy that Illinois substantive standard. And, you know, and certainly in this case, you only had one expert even doing that. Mr. Leitzinger was excluded. So you only had Mr. Rota, and it was his opinion that they were reasonable, but that's exactly what Ivy found was insufficient with respect to two experts. And there's a good reason for that.
Did your expert also share the opinion that applying the appropriate discount, you could end up in the range of 60 to 95 million?
Your Honor, I think he agreed based on a number that he had seen in a report that if you took the projections, the estimates and assumptions, and then you discounted them, you could get to a number in that area. But the problem is the estimates in the first place. That's the reasonably sure basis of facts that are absent here. Mr. Frank admitted he never looked at sales data from any company. This is at A13-18-19 and A13-23. Then later at appendix 13-22, he's assuming that the scale of e-commerce would just kick in. Here's the question was, why did you go from 4,000 wheel loaders and excavators to 6,500? The assumption was that the scale of the e-commerce platform would start to kick in. Question, it's an assumption? It is. Not based on any data you reviewed? Correct. He did the same thing with respect to regulatory compliance. He was asked, and this is at A1321, he conceded that the equipment that Long King was trying to sell at the beginning. Remember, he projected sales from the very first month, and he admitted that these forklifts couldn't be sold in the U.S. because they weren't compliant, right? Yes. Why did you assume 2 years later you'd be selling 1,600 forklifts? Answer, well, because we assumed we'd be selling by 2016. Question, I understand you assumed it. Why did you assume it? Answer, because I felt that the market share achievement would be reasonable in that period of time. With all respect, that is not historical data, which is what Ivy says has to happen. It has to be present. It's simply, as Ivy says, the specter of speculation.
Frank also say that he developed those projections based on the Yanks Associate reports?
Your Honor, the only role that, first of all, that's the only outside data involved anywhere here. And all that the Yanks report did was, and this is at A1195-96, all it did was establish what's the market size in North America. So he says the market size is the data we pulled out of that, the total market, as opposed to what we would be achieving. So that's what Mr. Frank did to come up with these numbers. He took the total market size, and then he just assumed, he reverse engineered, well, we'll get 0.5% market share in the first year, and that sort of accords to this many sold, this many machines sold in the first year. And he just assumed that they would grow each year and then eventually hit 15% of the market by year five. And the only basis he had for that was his own prior experience at Volvo and Sany, but by his own admission, that was because they had traditional dealer networks. This is at A1132. How did you accomplish that market share increase at Volvo? Answer, working with dealers, we focused completely on them. And then at 1134-35, he's describing how he grew it at Sany. We took them from about four dealers. We added 24 dealers and took their market share from essentially zero to 1.5%. But he himself, the whole point of ICP was not to use that traditional dealer network. It was to be completely, essentially online. That was the whole point. In fact, he says at A1239, he's discussing the dealership model, the traditional model that he is departing from. Says, the dealer networks are not bad. I would just argue that their time had come to slide over and allow a different platform like we had seen in other e-commerce platforms succeed. That is the whole point of ICP. That's why it was unprecedented. That's why it was, as Mr. Frank said, really provocative. That's why ICP's sales director put a new approach to selling equipment. It's why Mr. Lee, the CEO, said it was, quote, a new business venture.
But the argument you're making would seem to foreclose any entrepreneur with a new business model, even withdrawn from existing business models and a sort of amalgam of them, from ever receiving lost profits. And that's not the law of Illinois, right?
It's not. And certainly, Illinois law says that a new business can establish lost profits, but certainly it says that there's a specter of speculation. And all Mr. Frank had to do was do exactly what Ivy says, look at historical data, look at...
There's not historical data of exactly that business because it is a new entrepreneurial business. Doesn't your argument rule out the ability to obtain lost profits?
Respectfully, Honor, it does not, because Mr. Frank could have done a lot of things. He could have looked at how have Chinese companies, or certainly in the heavy manufacturing space, sold in America? How have traditional brick and mortar companies made sales when they moved to online? You know, he could have done any one of these things to come up with some sort of historical data in order to have some reasonable basis, a reasonably certain, not just reasonable basis, reasonably certain basis for these lost profits. Instead, what he did was he reverse engineered. He simply started with the entire size of the market. And then he said, well, we're going to start with 0.5%. He says at A1205, we thought 0.5% market share was doable. And then he just grew it from there based on practices at completely different companies and his own assumption that the scale of the e-commerce platform would start to kick in. And I think if you, yeah, I mean, I would think that certainly the fact that he was not able to get a single investor aside from his brother to invest any money in this supposedly gangbusters venture that was going to reinvent the entire approach to selling new heavy construction equipment, they didn't get any outside investors because, as he admitted, and it wasn't because of all these other reasons, it was because the projections gave them pause. And you've never seen another company try to enter the space, not any of the larger established companies, no other startup. No one has tried to enter this space. And I think it's precisely because this was such an unprecedented venture. And when you've got that situation, frankly, under Ivy, even when you don't, but certainly when you do, you have an obligation. I mean, they are the ones who chose lost profits as their damages theory. And under Illinois law, when you do that, you have to, quote, establish those damages with reasonable certainty. And it is a legal threshold and it is a matter of law. And that's why in Ivy, and TAS, you had decisions on summary judgment that decided that as a matter of law. And we simply do not have that here.
Say we disagree with you, and we get to the next question of whether it would be manifestly unjust to let this figure stand, whether you're entitled to a new trial. Speak to us about why you've given an industry that is upwards of $20 billion, $100 million verdict is manifestly unjust.
Well, Your Honor, there's certainly been, to our knowledge, and I didn't see ICP arguing otherwise, any verdict of tortious interference with contract under Illinois law that has come close to this. And I think when you combine that with the fact that, this was based on a contract between ICP and Iron Planet that was 4-year and it had capped damages. And, instead, what they decided to do was they decided to go after Caterpillar, even though there's correspondence with ICP, with Iron Planet, and particularly with Long King. I mean, if you look at the correspondence between ICP and Long King, ICP is blaming Long King, justly so, for, quote, killing the business. You are destroying our business. Long King has caused severe financial damage to ICP. Buy this business from me or repay me for all these losses. And so to go from that to a $100 million verdict based, again, on Mr. Frank's own assumptions in many respects, both the scale of e-commerce, both the sales that they were going to make, even in the first year. If you look at, for example, JTX1, this is the Excel spreadsheet with Mr. Frank's projections. And if you go to tab 4, which is year one detail, you actually have to go into the file to see this, cell J3, he's projecting in March 2014, the very first month that ICP has ever been in the public existence, because remember, they had their big coming out party in early March 2014. He's projecting sales of 21 pieces of heavy machinery in the first month of its existence.
I think we understand the point. We've gone over time, but we'll hear from you in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Please, the court, Catherine Forrest for International Construction Projects. Your Honor, I will get to both questions that we've been focused on today, but I want to just immediately go to a few of the points that my adversary raised in his argument. First of all, that all of the Frank testimony that my adversary had mentioned had been subject to cross-examination on the very points that he raised, every single piece of it. And the jury was fully entitled to and did consider that cross-examination on those very points.
But our deference to the jury is not blind. We have an obligation to apply the reasonable certainty standard as a matter of law.
That is correct, Your Honor.
How is that satisfied with the basis for projections here?
Right, Your Honor, the way in which that is satisfied is really through the record evidence, which the jury was fully entitled to review, and the cross-examination of that evidence. And so there was lots of evidence that was not mentioned in the court's opinion in granting the JMOL that was before the jury and which the jury was entitled to see. And as a point just of reference, there had been a summary judgment decision which the district court had considered relating specifically to the Ivy case, decided in April of 2024, and went through precisely the projections and whether the projections were too speculative to be shown to the jury. And the district court said, no, they were not too speculative to be shown to the jury. There were, however, put in front of the jury at trial, an 8-day trial, there were essentially three prongs of very robust evidence. The first prong related to all of the expertise of the ICP, the International Construction Products, their individuals, their advisory board, and their process, which I'll go through in just a moment. The second prong was all of the experience and the wherewithal of their partner with this, which was Iron Planet, the entity with whom it had contracted. And the third prong was the robustness and the competitiveness globally of Longking, who was going to be manufacturing the very products that were at issue. So if I might just show the, Your Honors, or reference for Your Honor, some of that evidence that was before the jury that supported reasonable certainty and that was not cited by the district court. For instance, both Lee and Frank were the two individuals who had extensive decades of experience in selling precisely the kind of equipment that would have been sold here, the heavy construction equipment. Both of them were experienced in increasing market share in new areas, new markets with Chinese equipment, both of them. And both of them actually had, along with an advisory board, direct participation in going through and vetting the projections. So for instance, Lee and his projections and his participation in the projections that form the basis for part of the business plan is at A1022. There is Frank, who also had grown a business by 5% over 3 years with a foreign heavy equipment manufacturer. That's at A1131 to 32. He actually worked on the projections, not just by himself picking numbers out of the air, but with a whole series of individuals, which he testified to, went through multiple iterations and on which were spent hundreds of hours. The advisory board included an ex-Sany, S-A-N-Y, chairman, which is a Chinese company of heavy construction equipment, just like that here at A1931. A former Volvo SVP of American accounts for heavy construction at A1931. These are the people who were working with ICP on their advisory board to bring the robust experience to actually kick the tires of those projections, yanks.
The Seventh Circuit and Task Distribution was addressing arguments like this, where past successes were raised as a basis for shoring up the certainty of projections. I rejected that notion. That's not sufficient information to calculate lost profits of the present corporation. Why shouldn't we follow that guidance from the Seventh Circuit?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, it would actually be a terrible policy point if you could never have a new business, as you had mentioned with my adversary, if you could never have a new business that could have well-grounded, robust, vetted lost profit analysis or projections of a business, and then have a lost profit analysis based on that for a new business. If you could essentially strangle it before the business ever got off the ground and then deny that business lost profits because it had never gotten off the ground, that would in fact make no sense.
Where is that analysis here?
Well,
I mean, here I understand you're pointing to drawing on past successes, on past experience as general background, but where Frank didn't even look at those revenues and projections of other companies, how could drawing on his background compensate to meet the threshold of reasonable certainty?
Well, first, Your Honor, Lee and Frank were working on this together along with an entire advisory board. The idea that Frank was a lone wolf is not true. Lee himself went to China. He sat there at the manufacturing plant. He assured himself that the manufacturing plant, Longking, would be able, in fact, to provide the quality of equipment that he expected. He also himself kicked the tires of those projections. He used the Yanks, who was on the advisory board. Yanks was an information source for heavy construction equipment. He used that. He also used a Credit Suisse report, as did Rhoda. Rhoda was qualified as an expert by the district court at trial in financial projections. Rota testified that he had looked at hundreds of projections in heavy equipment. He himself had been in the business of this selling this kind of heavy equipment, and he looked at each and every year. He analyzed each and every year, and he found that the projections were in fact reasonable. But more than that, Your Honor, Long King itself, there was evidence in the record that Long King itself had a history of being able to manufacture globally competitive heavy construction equipment. This was not some startup fly-by-night company that was going to be coming into the United States. In fact, Caterpillar had in its competitive documents, which were before the jury, it had documents which looked at Long King as a competitor in heavy construction equipment. Caterpillar was so concerned about the entry of Long King into the U.S. market in exactly the way that it was going to be brought into the U.S. market with ICP and Iron Planet, that Caterpillar then interfered with the contract.
Doesn't that introduce the unique factor here that poses a problem in drawing on either Caterpillar's sales or Iron Planet's, and that is introducing the Chinese equipment into the U.S. where there were questions about its quality and the willingness of consumers to shift over to that company and that sort of product. That's you can point to what was happening with Long King worldwide, but isn't the problem here that there are unique circumstances that need to be taken into account in making any sorts of projections of lost profits in the United States?
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree, and I would put the following evidence before Your Honor again with the concept of the standard of review for the jury's verdict on this very point. We had a situation with Long King where Caterpillar itself showed that there was competition between new and used equipment and was concerned about the Long King equipment coming in to the U.S. market at a 43% discount to new, which would make it competitive with used. And in Caterpillar's own documents at A1972, A1944, A1931, there are three competitive analyses from Caterpillar, which show that Caterpillar itself understood that Long King could make inroads. It was also concerned with used and new competing. There is no evidence in the record, no testimony, that there is a functional difference between when you drive the excavator off the lot and it goes from being new to being used, that there's any functional difference at all. There was no cross-examination, no affirmative testimony of any functional difference between new and used.
There was significant evidence in the record about problems of quality with Long King's equipment that raised serious questions about whether it could even effectively be sold in the United States.
Yes, Your Honor. There were questions that had been raised that were ex post facto. It was after the interference with the contract. After that, there was an attempt by ICP to try and sell its demo equipment. Now, there was also testimony in the record from Mr. Frank that demo equipment is made differently. It's for show. It's made differently than the regular kind of equipment that you actually bring into the United States in the first instance for sale. And that there was testimony from Mr. Frank, which the jury was entitled to consider, that demo equipment is often then fixed up and then sold, and sometimes sold at a discount as a result of that. So the Long King issues are also to be measured against the fact that in the Caterpillar documents of looking at Long King as a competitor, Caterpillar recognized that Long King was the largest global manufacturer of wheel loaders in the world. It was a globally successful manufacturer. There was also evidence in the record that the jury was entitled to consider that prior to the termination of the contract, ICP had never heard any complaints from Iron Planet about anything that it had been doing. That also the sales that Iron Planet was going to assist ICP with making, because the contract also had a kind of partnership, if you will, aspect to it, where they were going to be working together in terms of the sales. You see that on the second page of the hosted sales contract. You see that had never been able to get off the ground before the contract was terminated. So yes, there were problems. When Long King knew that the contract had been interfered with, Long King no longer had an active distribution network in the United States, but it was selling $60 billion worth of equipment worldwide. The jury was also able to consider, in terms of the projections, if we can go back to that for a moment, that Caterpillar itself recognized that against the projections, JTX1, against those projections was a market opportunity from Caterpillar's own documents of a $100 billion global market, $29 billion North American market, where what ICP was attempting to do was only take a small amount of that. And Frank and Lee had led companies with Chinese manufactured equipment that had actually been able to take share. Volvo, Mr. Frank, had actually increased share by 5%. So we had lots of evidence that the jury was able to consider in all of this regard. But might I say a couple of words about the hosted store agreement? The hosted store agreement is very important because there's an exclusivity provision, which I would direct your honors to, the exclusivity provision, which says that Iron Planet will only sell new equipment for ICP, and it will still be able to, however, sell new equipment on its platform as it had done in the past for liquidations. So the idea that Iron Planet could never sell new equipment is not true. It's in the contract that they excluded the ability to sell new liquidated equipment. It's also in the contract that there would be brick and mortar Iron Planet personnel on the ground. That's in the contract, and that dealers would be on the ground to assist ICP at the beginning. So you had dual distribution at A-1914, A-1959, A-1935. In fact, Caterpillar itself recognized that there might be 20 to 30 dealers on the ground who would be selling equipment, not just through Iron Planet. But the Iron Planet platform was not like Ivy, going to be a brand new fangled platform that had to be created. In Ivy, the platform never existed. In this case, it was going to be the same platform that's stated on pages 1 and 2 of that contract. Might I go to manifest injustice with my last 4.5 minutes?
You may.
All right. The standard of review here is very important. On page A22 of the court's decision, the court actually said that if there was a reversal on damages, it would be because there was substantial certainty, and it therefore denied the motion for a new trial based on manifest injustice. That brings us into an abuse of discretion review for purposes of the manifest injustice argument. But let me just describe why a $100 million could not be manifestly unjust. First of all, the damages, which were a discount off of the potential revenues and profit in JTX1, were only $249 million is what Leitzinger, the economist, had asked for, up to 249. That was already a discount off of JTX1. Never in all of the pretrial argumentation in the Daubert motion for both Leitzinger and for Rota was it ever raised that a $249 million judgment would be outrageous, would be manifestly unjust? There were lots of arguments about their methodology, but none that said that this would shock the conscience. But the jury did not come back with $249 million. It came back with $100 million. That $100 million can be justified by, as Your Honor has already mentioned, Dr. Murphy, who is the economist for Caterpillar, who actually, in doing a mathematical discount rate that he was asked to do on cross, it was not testimony he wanted to give, recognized that using that discount rate for a new business would result in a $95 million amount of damages.
But that was working off of the assumptions that you had given to him.
His
starting position was that it was zero.
That's absolutely true, Your Honor.
And here we're talking about a one-year contract.
Okay.
And subject to, you know, a couple of years of renewal. But beyond that, with the one-year contract where all that had been sold was a single piece of equipment in the time that they had together, brief as it may have been, but a single piece of equipment, how can $100 million be anything but speculative?
Let me talk about the five-year contract. First of all, the five-year contract was never raised during cross-examination of any witness. If you look at Mr. Rhoda, if you look at Mr. Murphy and his methodology, nobody ever said, by the way, the damage should be cut down because of the five-year contract. The Supreme Court in the Story case said the jury is able to make a reasonable inference. The five-year contract The five-year projections were a one-year contract, 2 years of automatic renewal, 3 years. If you believed the projections, you were going to believe you had a successful business. Story says that the jury could make a reasonable inference. One reasonable inference a jury was entitled to make is people wouldn't walk away from a highly successful business. But in any event, Your Honor, there was no cross-examination of any witness that this five-year contract, which was this five-year projections, were somehow based on a contract that could not support them. What the jury did have was Rhoda, who was never cross-examined on this point, that five-year projections are industry standard. It's also the case you go to JTX1, you're able to look at the first 3 years and come up with $84 million on gross profits itself. So there are multiple ways. What the jury did was pick a middle ground of $100 million. That is 0.1% of the market opportunity of $100 billion overall, if you were to look at the global opportunity. So the jury was not picking a number out of the air. The jury was picking a number that was grounded in the evidence it had at trial. I see I'm out of time.
Thank you. That's the argument. And I hear you in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few points in rebuttal. Number one, I heard my colleague talk about that over and over that this was a question for the jury, that there was an expert. As we've discussed previously, IB makes clear that there is a legal question to be determined by the court and that experts are not sufficient when there's no historical data. That's why in IB there were two experts, same as in TAS, and there was still no lost profits found. Second thing I want to talk about is my friend referred to the ICP executive's experience, quote, selling precisely the kind of equipment that would be sold here. Number one, I don't think the record shows that at all. This is equipment that had never been sold in the United States by a company that had never had any presence in the United States, that was known for having, as the record shows, quality issues, that was not regulatory compliance, and that there was no evidence that it would be. Again, Mr. Frank simply just assumed that they would come into compliance at a certain point, or that he assumed that they would get engines from a domestic manufacturer that were in compliance. There was no evidence for that. Judge Krause, you honed in on the question, which is, well, where did the sales numbers come from? You know, where's the historical data from either Long King or any other company that was in the US or Iron Planet and its sales data? With all respect, I don't think you got an answer to the critical question of where did the sales numbers come from. That's the assumption here. That's the speculation. And it's not just where did they come from in the first instance, but how did they grow? And if you look at the evidence, 813-18 to 19, 813-23, 13-22, it's all in Mr. Frank's own estimates and speculation. My friend referred repeatedly to the overall market size. Well, that's not sufficient to show sales, particularly of a new and unprecedented company. I mean, just because the market size happens to be very large in the United States does not mean that you can just assume, as Mr. Frank did, that in the very first year, ICP is going to have 0.5% of that market. Now, that's, you know, a relatively small number, but it's still huge for a completely new concept. I want to talk a little bit also about this idea that there was a partnership or there were dealers that were also going to sort of help out with this. I think that's belied by the statements of Mr. Frank himself, who said that the dealer networks are not bad, but I think it's time that they slide over and allow a different platform like we've seen in other e-commerce platforms to succeed. And in fact, even at page 6 of ICP's opening brief, they say the sales were primarily direct online sales. So the whole point of ICP was not to use this traditional dealer network. In fact, at A1572 to 74, Mr. Frank admits there were no dealers at the start. They didn't have any dealers. That was the whole point. And if they were trying to sort of convince their customers to become dealers, he said, well, it was hard because Lawn King is an unfamiliar product and they didn't have any product to show them
but
at the time.
To the extent they were straying from brick and mortar, there was the proxy of the warranty, the multi-point inspection, again, with a new business, with an entrepreneurial business, there may not be an exact match.
Well, Your Honor, there may not be, but that means that you can't just assume that there will be. And to go back again to JTX1, if you do nothing else in this case after this argument, look at March 2014 and Mr. Frank's projections for March 2014, which is the only month we have where there was actual sales, you know, sales efforts by ICP, and it had made its public coming out earlier that month. He projects that there will be 21 sales in the first month alone, which, you know, I think facially is totally implausible, but they ended up selling one. And it, to be clear, this isn't a numbers game. This isn't like, well, if he had only chosen 17 and they had sold three, it'd be okay. The point is that he had no basis for the 21. He had no basis for the 189 that he assumed for the entire first year. The last point I want to make is regarding this competitive documents that my friend referred to. As we point out in our brief, this was just parroting Mr. Frank's own statement that they were going to sell 300 in the first year. So it's not anything that Caterpillar did, but I think that 300 is important because it just shows that Mr. Frank is making it up. He says 300 to the press. His projections say 189. There's no basis for any of it. And as you pointed out, Your Honor, you need to have historical data. There's nothing here. They chose to try to prove lost profits. Illinois law makes it very clear you have to be reasonably certain and have a reasonably sure basis of facts for that as a matter of law. And that was not the case here.
Do you view the jury's reduction from Frank's original projections to be representative of it, that those projections were not reasonable as presented, were not fully reasonable?
No, Your Honor, because I think that the jury could only take the evidence that was given to them of the actual projections. And if, you know, the phrase goes garbage in, garbage out, and if the projections were assumptions and estimates to begin with, I don't think it's an answer to say, well, you know, they cut it down by 40%. I mean, if you really were going to do that, you know, and maybe this goes more towards the manifest injustice or miscarriage of justice, then again, look at March 2014. You know, he estimated 21, they sold one. And so I think that, you know, the fundamental disconnect there, again, it's not a numbers thing. It's really all about where did these projections come from in the first place? And, you know, with respect, I don't think my friend answered that question. And I don't think there is an answer. It was all speculation.
So would the district court have been permitted to go through the projections line by line and say, this line is reasonable, this line is not, and construct a new damages award based on its assessment of reasonable certainty?
Your Honor, I don't think it could because, frankly, it is ICP's evidentiary burden to prove damages. They chose to prove damages. There's other ways to prove damages, including for new companies. You know, you can do enterprise value, something along those lines. They chose to prove it through lost profits. And when you do that, Illinois law sets, as you said, Your Honor, a very high standard for doing that. And they didn't have to do it. And I think that's why they're asking for North Carolina law. And I'm happy to just refer you to our briefing that that's been waived and is the same standard anyway. But I think that that's why you see them, you know, arguing for that, because Illinois law, as Judge Andrews recognized, for a totally unprecedented venture that is selling new equipment online, never been done before, never been done since, and no investors, that is completely speculative.
Right. So even within the realm of Illinois law, if the district court thought that the projections for, say, lifts were reasonably certain and it didn't think the other projections were reasonably certain, could it award, adjust the damages award to account for those, the subset that was certain?
Your Honor, I think it, perhaps as part of a new trial, a remitted or a request or something along those lines, you know, if the district court wanted to do so, I suppose it could, but I think that, you know, it was simply looking at LA law and the Ivy case and the TAS case from the Seventh Circuit, which in very similar circumstances, simply said, there's simply no evidence. You did not satisfy the legal burden of competent evidence to show reasonably certain damages. If there are no further questions.
Any questions?
No.
All right. Thanks to both counsel for the briefing and the helpful argument this morning. We will take this case under advisement.